This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us today. Why do we work? What motivates us to achieve? These are the types of questions that social theorist Barry Schwartz researches and writes about, and his answers sometimes defy conventional logic on the subject. He's announced his retirement from teaching at Swarthmore College, so I thought we'd revisit our past conversation. We talked about the ways in which employers and teachers can better encourage workers and students to reach higher and do better. Let's take a listen. Is it mysterious motivation?
Well, I think it's mysterious. In some ways, it's mysterious. It's much more complicated than most people assume. And let me just give you an example, which really was the main finding in the study of the West Point cadets. Imagine that you are passionately in love with molecular biology. You want to learn everything you can about molecular biology, and you're taking classes, but you're really highly motivated. You have exams, and you're highly motivated to get good grades in the exams. You would think that somebody who is just passionate about molecular biology will not be as motivated as someone who is passionate about molecular biology and wants to get A's on exams. Two reasons to work hard are better than one. And the result that we found with West Point cadets, and I think you also find it in educational settings, is that two reasons are not better than one. We found some cadets who were motivated by what we call internal characteristics of the work. They wanted to serve their country. They wanted to lead and so on. Others had that motivation but also wanted to develop skills and contacts that would get them a good job when they left the military. And what we found is that the people with both of those reasons, internal and instrumental, were less good at West Point, less good in the military, and less likely to stay in the military than people who just wanted to be good soldiers.
Which is a very provocative finding, that these sort of instrumental reasons sort of undo the internal reasons.
Right, and the typical presumption that we have is you have kids who are pretty interested in being good students, so you just need to goose them a little bit by giving them something else to work for, gift certificates for electronic stuff or meals at McDonald's or something. It can't possibly hurt, and maybe this will be just a little extra that will get them really committed to doing their work excellently. Well, it turns out it can hurt.
I mean, there is a subset of parents described often as you know, high-achieving parents who, you know, have their children studying Chopin and writing plays and doing all these extracurricular activities as a way of, I guess, getting them into the right colleges. But at the same time, is that
That's a disaster.
Okay.
When my piece came out, when Amy's and my piece came out in the New York Times, I got an email from a high school student who did a half-hour documentary at a very high-achieving, wealthy community, interviewing her classmates who were about to go off to college about why they had worked the way they had in high school, what was the point, what were they hoping for, what actually happened in To Kill a Mockingbird. And what she found was one blank. It was the most heartbreaking thing I ever. These were straight A students going to Swarthmore and Haverford and Harvard and Princeton, and they couldn't tell you one thing about why they were doing what they were doing.
That is so depressing.
Except it was the next step on the road to something. And I think this obsessive concern on the part of parents to make sure their kids have every advantage creates, you know, this kind of instrumental orientation at a time that should be the most exciting time in a kid's intellectual life. It's much harder to assess people's progress in finding meaning and engagement in their work than to see the effect of a bonus. But I think it's more than that, too. I think when you're motivating people by giving them bonuses, you have almost complete control of the situation. You add the bonus and work goes up. You take away the bonus and work goes down. You're in charge. You're not in charge of the meaning and engagement that people get from their work. They're much more autonomous. So you have to give up control to some degree when you rely on that instead of on incentives. Also, think about what it would take to get kids in school really excited about learning. You'd have to transform the school system. It's a lot easier to give people McDonald's gift certificates and wait for the next generation to figure out how to transform the school system. So I think it's a much harder problem to solve than just giving employers better feedback on how their employees are doing.
Well, I was thinking about the school system, not just Philadelphia's, but across the country. And a number of districts are giving financial incentives mm-hmm. to teachers if they can get their students not just grades up, but that their test scores up, seeing that as a reward for hard work done or hard work accomplished. Is that counterproductive from your perspective?
So here's the thing. The evidence so far is that it will, in fact, improve test scores and it will not increase learning. Because we all know there are ways to teach kids to do well on tests that doesn't have much to do with how much they actually learn. And in the most egregious cases, these cases in Georgia, teachers just cheated. They took the kids' answer sheets and they changed the answers. So will it improve test scores? Absolutely. Will it improve what the test scores are meant to be measuring? That's much less clear. But I also think that you can certainly arrange things to make it more or less likely that your efforts to appeal to what's intrinsic to your students will be successful. If you're highly regimented, if you're carrying around a ruler to rap people on the knuckles and stuff like that, well, you'll kill intrinsic motivation, and you certainly won't nurture any.
Right.
If you have a different environment in the classroom, you will nurture it where it's already there, and you may actually create it in a few people where it isn't there. So institutional structures and practices certainly can have big effects on the likelihood. What people always think is that the reason this happens is that the incentives are dumb. If we came up with smarter incentives that really were rewarding people for the things we cared about, then you wouldn't have these kinds of problems. I don't think anyone has figured out incentives that are as smart as doing a great job because you want to do a great job.
I mean, some jobs just are boring. I mean, I'm trying to imagine being someone working at a toll booth, for instance, taking all the things that we've talked about. You know, how would we motivate someone if that was their job?
Well, I think the toll booth is really an anomalous case because it is so essentially non-social. Almost all the work people do involves interacting with other people. You're working at McDonald's, your demeanor can affect whether the meal that this family has is a pleasant one or a sort of sullen one based on your openness to them when they show up to order whatever it is they're going to order. To the extent that your job includes interacting with other people, there is always the opportunity to make it meaningful and enrich it by caring about how that interaction goes. When you're working in isolation in a toll booth, I'm stumped.
Well, but picking up on that, I mean, more and more people are working at home, working on computers. Yes, they might be interacting, but not in that kind of face-to-face way that one can get it.
It doesn't have to be face-to-face. If you're developing software that people are going to use and you're imagining, people who are developing software are developing it so that other people can use it. You just have to make sure that that's a salient characteristic of the work, whether they work at home or they work in an office.
We were talking actually right before the air, and you reminded me about this supermarket story in Massachusetts, and I didn't connect with this. Go ahead.
This is an unbelievable story. It should transform the organization of workplaces all over America. These two cousins were having a fight for control of Market Basket, which is a very successful supermarket chain in New England. One of the cousins thought, well, we have a mission in the community. We serve customers. We also serve our staff. He paid generously. He discounted everything in the store by 10% in response to the financial catastrophe.
For the employees,
for
everybody.
Every customer.
Wow.
10% off your bill because you're having a harder – you need the money more than I do.
Wow.
And his cousin thought, this isn't how you run a business. So they had this fight. His cousin forced him out, and there was a massive strike. All the employees, all the customers, the store was empty, the shelves were empty, and this went on. And it was high risk for the employees. They weren't unionized. They could all have lost their jobs and been replaced in a heartbeat. And just yesterday, the good cousin won the battle. And, of course, you know, they're incredibly successful, and their employees are eager to come to work, and they feel like they're serving an important social and community function, as indeed they are. Well, if a janitor in a hospital can feel that way, and a checkout clerk in a supermarket can feel that way, then it seems to me there's almost no job that doesn't offer the possibility of the kind of meaningfulness and satisfaction.
Mm. Taking what we've been talking about, does that translate to parenthood?
Well, I
think... Or is that a different kind of... It's a different kind of relationship, perhaps a different kind of interaction.
It is. It is. I think most parents, at least most parents among the, quote, educated elite, want to raise kids who find meaning and engagement in the work that they do, who are eager to go to work every day, who think they're in some way improving somebody's life so that they'll be enthusiastic about it. I think the best way parents have of nurturing that in kids is by modeling it. So if you actually hate your job, it's almost certainly going – we are teaching our kids all the time, and I think they learn most from us when we are not trying to teach them. So
when they're just observing us.
They're just observing us. And the same thing is true if you're a teacher in a classroom. You tell your kids do A, B, and C, but meanwhile you're not doing A, B, and C, and that's what they learn.
Right.
So I think we want that. We want our kids to be happy with their lives, and we spend half our waking lives working. So that means being happy with their work or getting satisfaction out of their work.
I'm thinking of the Andre Agassi memoir where he talked about the fact that he hated and perhaps hates tennis. We know what an extraordinary career he had. So it seems to me, and there's a member of the Philadelphia Orchestra talked about how much he hated practicing as a kid and his mother made him do it. And for some people, they do it in spite of everything. Barry, I'm looking at you.
I think that's right. That's why motivation is mysterious and complicated. Most of the time when you hate it, you're going to stop doing it.
Yes,
every
exactly.
Now and then you become a world-class tennis player or a world-class musician. Mostly either the joy of accomplishing excellence on the tennis court or in the orchestra takes over, or you stop.
Yeah.
You often need to find ways to coax people. It doesn't have to be bribing kids with money. You find a way to turn practice into a game or something like that. And sort of accidentally, the kid learns to be a better musician or a better tennis player. And then at that point, it's the joys that are associated with demonstrating your excellence take over. But I think it's a bad idea to take a look at these occasional anomalies of
yes.
people who hated it and nonetheless yes. persisted and achieved excellence and regard that as a model for how motivation works for most of us.
That was my 2014 interview with Swarthmore Professor Barry Schwartz, author of several books and articles on motivation and work. A symposium is being held tomorrow to honor him as he retires from his post at Swarthmore College. When we get back from the break, we'll listen to my interview with writer Paul Eli about Bach, whose birthday is on Monday. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. In the world of music, listeners may enjoy the lasting impact of the Beatles or even bluesman Robert Johnson, but the influence of these 20th century artists pale in comparison to Johann Sebastian Bach, whose influence has lasted more than 300 years. Because Bach's birthday is on Monday, we thought we should revisit my conversation with writer Paul Eli. When he joined us in 2012, we discussed Bach's life and how his music has long been so open to interpretation, which he wrote about in his book, Reinventing Bach. Let's take a listen. What is it about how Bach approached composing, you think, that has inspired so many people?
His music is paradoxical. It's got the best of both worlds musically, let's say. It sounds very personal and yet not autobiographical. A piece that's by Bach, it's hard to think that it's by anybody else, and yet it's open to adaptation on different instruments, in different contexts. You can play it with a small orchestra or a large one. You can be Jethro Tull working it out for flute and guitar, or do it by the letter as it was done in 1710. I think people would say Bach did the music of joy better than anybody else, and yet it's never saccharine. Mm. He knows death. He knows the dark side of life, and there's great vigor to even his simplest pieces, the ones that kids learn to play.
And do you think the fact that he was an organist, I mean, he played other instruments as well, but he was an organist, also helps us to understand his music? And as you also say, he was an inventor in his own right.
Well, the organ was the most complex piece of machinery that most people of his time encountered. It was either an organ or a ship. We don't think of Bach as a techie, but that's what he was. You had to know how the organ worked. You had to know how to put it together when it came apart. You had to know how to remake it to your own specifications. So he was a very technical musician. And at that time, the organ was seen as the instrument of instruments. The organ could do all the things that other instruments could do and then some. And that, I think, explains just how comprehensive Bach's musical achievement is. He was the master of the instrument of them all for his period.
You write a lot about Glenn Gould in this book, and I do want to play a recording. This is a 1955 recording of Bach's Goldberg Variations number 5. But before we listen to that, why is it important to hear Glenn Gould playing Bach?
Well, Glenn Gould is the musician in whose hands Bach really became modern. The way I think about it, we're used to thinking of the composer back there and then the performers, you know, far removed from the composer. And then we don't think about the recordings as writers outside of the shop or outside of our home. So what I try to do in the book is put it all together. All these musicians are really all playing on the Bach team. Gould is the one who assimilated so much of the music that had gone before him because he could listen to records and then make a record that 60 years later still has the sparkle of a new work for us.
Let's listen again to Glenn Gould's 1955 recording of Bach's Goldberg Variations number 5. You write in your book, what did Gould seek in Bach? What do you think he sought in Bach?
In Bach, he sought a musician who, like himself, made use of technology to make his music more human. For Gould, the recording studio was not an impersonal place, a sterile environment where he could make music perfectly. It was a place where he could discover Bach. He would play the pieces over and over, not to get them perfect, but to find something in them that would surprise even himself. And I think we can hear some of that sense of discovery in the performance that you just played.
In fact, he in his career gave up performing out in public and really preferred the recording studio.
He did, but it's usually thought that that was that he's a hermit and that he withdrew. This was the place where he felt most human and most fully alive. And it was also really practical. In 25 years in the recording studio, he made dozens of recordings, and it's now clear in retrospect, because he died at 50, that if he hadn't taken all that time in the studio, we wouldn't have all that music of his.
And made classical music recordings quite popular.
That's right. He had a sense of what sounded good on record as opposed to what sounded good in the concert hall, and then he would do it over again the next day in the recording studio. This was the place for him. We're sitting in a recording studio now, and this is where he made his music.
Let me play something that would be familiar to Philadelphians. This is Leopold Stokowski leading the Philadelphia Orchestra in Johann Sebastian Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor. This is a recording that goes back to 1927, so it will not sound like a modern recording. What should we listen for in this from your perspective, Paul?
So it's a long time ago, so it's hard to imagine that this was a recording in which Stokowski's ability as a conductor, his power as a showman, and his mastery of the recording process all came together. There'd been 15 years of so-called acoustic recordings. Good microphones were introduced and better ways of arranging things to get better sound. And Stokowski adapted to that. Then he came up with a transcription of a Bach organ work that could take advantage of the fact that he now had technology at his disposal in a double sense, the 100-piece orchestra that he led and not the recording studio in this case because it was recorded at the Academy of Music, but the process of recording. So the showman, the conductor, the transcriber of Bach, and the recording pioneer, all in one man, Stokowski, working together to make this recording.
Let's listen.
That's Leopold Stokowski leading the Philadelphia Orchestra in Johann Sebastian Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor, recorded in 1927. In your book, you include some interesting conversations between Walt Disney and Stokowski about this particular fugue. Can you take us into their conversation?
So Stokowski and Disney, they were similar figures in some ways. They were at the leading edge of their art, but they had a great sense of the public. They were populists. And they got together in Hollywood, and one thing led to another, and they decided to make this movie, Fantasia. Mm-hmm. And Stokowski had to prevail on Disney to open with the Toccata and Fugue in D minor. People thought it would be too difficult. It's an abstract piece. It wasn't written for orchestra, etc. And Stokowski got his way. So most people who were introduced to classical music by Fantasia were, in effect, introduced to classical music, first of all, by Johann Sebastian Bach. The visual effects match to the Toccata and Fugue in D minor as played by Stokowski and the Philadelphians.
Well, and you include some conversation between Disney and Stokowski, and it seems that Disney didn't quite get it, as you said. He didn't quite understand this piece of music.
Right. He's one of those people who liked to have it explained to him, but then he was ready to get it, and he was confident that this was also true of the people who would go to see the movie.
Disney says, what does the Toccata and Fugue represent? And Stokowski says, it's a motif or a decorative pattern which gradually develops more and more. Finally, it becomes perfectly free. The theme comes at the beginning, develops more and more, the more and more voices and instruments. It's a growth like a tree growing from a seed. It's a beautiful description of this piece of music.
It's fantastic. And you can see, if you know Fantasia, that the animators, they were given these notes from Stokowski, and they really acted on them. They tried to produce, through visual effects, a work that expanded and developed and went to new places and attained perfect freedom.
It's interesting to think, and your book in part tracks the evolution in technology and in recording as well. And as you had said earlier, Bach himself was an inventor. So it sort of makes sense that these new inventions, recording inventions, could carry his music forward. Can you help us understand how this technology developed?
So I'm listening to these records. I'm a devotee of Bach, but not a musicologist. I know the music through recordings. And suddenly as a writer, I realized that I've got an amazing story to tell. And partly it's because these people influence one another. Schweitzer influences Stokowski, and they both influence Pablo Casals, and they all influence Glenn Gould. And then I ask myself, well, how does that influence happen? Right. And it's in large part through recordings. And when I realized that the progress of recording technology tracks with the reinvention of Bach's music, then the story feels like a big, bold story about the times we live in. Because I think you can argue that recording technology is an invention that has as much bearing on the way we live our lives as just about anything, that our experience and our way of encountering the past and the arts comes as much through recording technology as through anything else. So I try to tell that story in the book. We start with 78 RPM records, and suddenly there's a recording studio devised. Then the LP is created. You can distribute longer works and better sound. Then there's this thing called stereo that enables us to hear the sound of the room in a new way. And then headphones, we can have an intimacy with that recording, and we're off and running.
Yeah, and earbuds and all the ways that we can listen to music now.
When I was first getting into the music of Bach, I would listen to a Bach cantata on my way to work every day, walking in Manhattan. And it was about 20 minutes from where I lived to where I worked, and that's about how long a Bach cantata is. And so that struck me, but also it struck me that until about 25 years prior, until the 70s, you really couldn't walk to work listening to a Bach recording. This was an experience that's unique to our time. And I was just knocked out by this experience. In the long history of Bach, we're encountering it in a new way. Now that we have Bach on our phones, it's happening all over again.
You had mentioned Pablo Casals. You include him as an important person to understand as we see this reinvention of Bach. What did he bring to this composer and his music?
Casals is credited with supposedly discovering the cello suites. They'd been neglected. They weren't known even to great cellists like young Casals. He brought them into the body of work that now represents Bach. The second thing is he recognized a certain aptness of the recording studio for the cello suites. For him, they were the music of solitude. But you couldn't be alone with the cello suites prior to recordings unless you were the cellist, unless you were a king who could hire a cellist. Suddenly, he can go into what was then a state-of-the-art recording studio, Abbey Road Studios, brand new, and make a recording that transmits this solitude or this intimacy into the middle-class living room. And when he can do that, he can capture the cello suites for thousands of people in a way that hasn't been heard before. The strange thing about Abbey Road Studios, and I try to bring the strangeness across in a dramatic fashion in the book, is that it's a studio that's in a big house in St. John's Wood in London. So Casals has made the music of Bach the music of the modern house. He played it every day for 80 years as a benediction on his own house. And then he goes into this specially prepared house that is Abbey Road Studios and makes a record that can then make it house music for the bedsits in middle-class parlors of England and America and Europe.
Well, and there's some Bach influence here. We're going to play Beatles' In My Life from their 1965 album. This is Rubber Soul. Since we're talking about Johann Sebastian Bach, how does this fit in, Paul?
Well, as I'm writing this book and learning more about Bach, suddenly I realize that the argument I'm making is really turning out to be more true than I'd imagined. Bach really is everywhere. I'm reading a book about the Beatles, and it turns out that John Lennon, during the Rubber Soul sessions, said to George Martin, their producer, in the middle of the recording of In My Life, "Look, for the middle of this, can you come up with something like Bach on piano?" And they went out for a smoke or whatever outside the studio, and Martin, who was a decent amateur pianist, worked up a kind of Baroque-sounding piano figure, and he recorded it very slowly, and he was a producer. He knew the mechanics of these things. He knew how to speed it up so that at double speed, if the tape was run twice as fast, it would come out at the right tempo and in the right key. And that's what he did, and this is the middle section of In My Life.
And it sounds like a harpsichord.
That's right, and that's what a brilliant improvisation by this producer to be able to work with his skills, the needs of the song, and the technology to get just a harpsichord touch to this recording.
Let's listen.
Something you
Well, Paul, Eli, and I were just saying that song never gets old. There's something about just the harmonies and the way that they're playing.
The fact that Bach figures into the song must be part of that, that the Beatles were pushing things forward musically, but they knew well enough to take one of their best songs and add just a Baroque touch that would make it sound current 40 years later.
That was my 2012 conversation with Paul Eli, author of Reinventing Bach. When we get back from the break, we'll listen to bassist and composer Stanley Clark. Stay with us. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're a regular listener to Radio Times in Review, you've probably become familiar with this peppy tune playing underneath my voice. It's a song called Up by Philadelphia native Stanley Clark. And when we were looking for a theme for this show, Clark had joined us in the studio, and this song became an obvious choice. Clark is credited with taking the bass to the next level, bringing it from the background to the forefront. His work with Chick Corea in the fusion jazz band Return to Forever, as well as his solo work, has pushed the limits of jazz and rock into new territory. He joined us in 2014 to discuss his youth in Philadelphia and his constantly evolving musical career. Let's listen. You ended up playing the bass sort of by accident. It was the last instrument that was being handed out at the school you were attending?
Yeah, I think I was going to, I think it was a school called Levering Elementary School. And, you know, they wanted to know what kids wanted to play instruments, you know. So I went to the music room and I was a little late. So all these so-called, quote-unquote, good instruments were taken, right? And finally, what was left was like a bass drum and a sousaphone and an acoustic bass. Now, the acoustic bass was sitting in the corner, and the reason why I sort of gravitated toward that instrument was because there was just one. It was it. And so I figured, well, if I play this instrument, you know, I'll be the only one that plays that. And but then when I started playing the instrument, it had the nastiest sound you could ever hear. And it was like, you know. And so I just sort of made it my life goal to try to make the acoustic bass sound beautiful. And any bass that gets in my hand, I try to make it sound good. So,
and you do have this signature style. I mean, a way that you play the bass is really like nobody else.
Well, that's what they say, you know.
Yeah, that is what they say.
I'm a very, I think because of my mother, you know, my upbringing, you know, my mother was used to walk around the house singing opera all the time. She was a great painter as well. And she was very interested in music, and she sort of recognized me at a young age as having some interest in that. And she made sure that I, got into it, and she played music for me. And so I have a melodic sense. So it probably wouldn't have mattered what instrument I played. I would have had, like, however I feel about, you know, whatever my feelings about music are would have just passed through whatever instrument I had chosen, you know.
When you were a kid growing up in Philadelphia playing the bass, did you practice a lot? I mean, were you one of those really diligent students?
Yeah, I was maybe a little over the top, actually.
Really?
I would practice in the house, out the house, the side of the house. I didn't care if there was a space there and there was a bass there.
You would be playing.
I'm on.
You loved it so much?
Yeah. I wanted to achieve something. I had something very specific in my mind that I wanted to achieve musically. And it was, you know, it was kind of far from where I was at the time when I started.
Yeah.
And I just kept kept going at it, and then finally got there. So, you know, and now I have other things, other musical ideas with the bass and music and composition and other things that I'm going. I've set other goals, you know, but I was a real serious and avid practicer. Yeah.
And one of your goals was to play with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, like my mother, you know, she wanted me to like, it's funny. I think I've never mentioned this before anywhere, but my mother was not a big fan of my electric music.
Well, it was, I mean, sometimes I
brought my School Days album home. I said, here's a gold record. Here, look, Mom, check this out. She said, why are you doing this music? Why are you doing this?
She didn't hear it?
She didn't even listen to it. She was, you know, classical music, you know. And so, you know, I had this idea that I was going to join the Philly Orchestra, which I wanted to do, and I was preparing for that. But then I met Chick Corea, and he changed that. He came down here to Philadelphia, and we had a talk. And I think he said, what do you want to do that for?
And how old were you at the time?
I think I was like 18, something like
that. Oh, wow.
He says, you know, why do you want to do that? We're going to have a lot of fun. I said, really?
You and me, right.
And we did.
Well, I do want to get to that chapter, but yes. But I do want to play, you have a new rendition of one of your biggest hits, School Days.
Yeah, yeah.
It appeared on what, your original album?
Yeah, it was a 1976 album called School Days, I think. Yeah.
Why did you want to redo this?
It? Yeah. Well, I thought, why not? You know, I know a lot of rock and roll artists, they'll have certain songs that they deem to be classics, and they never redo it. Many times it's because they can't. In my case, I still play School Days, and I thought, well, you know, Miles Davis recorded the song So What 4 or 5 times. John Coltrane recorded many of his songs. I mean, at heart, I'm a jazz musician, so why should I not? Because something's a classic. It's just a word. And I redid it again, and one of the reasons is because the guitar player. Many guitar players approach me, and, man, I would love anything to record School Days with you. So this guy, Jimmy Herring, that plays guitar, he's one of the great southern rock guitar players now that still have that tradition now. You can hear it in his sound and his phrasing. And I always loved Jimmy, so I said, hey, let's do School Days. And he was very happy. He said, hey, man, thank you. So that's why we did it.
Let's give it a listen.
again, a new rendition of one of Stanley Clarke's biggest hits, School Days. It originally appeared on the 1976 album of the same name, and we are sort of rocking out listening to that. Mm-hmm. Talk just a bit about, though, how you do play. I realize we're on the radio, and so you can't do your fingers so well,
on
the radio.
Well, I think, if someone asks me why do you play the bass the way you do, a lot of it has to do with how I grew up. I was just talking to my friend earlier. I lived in a very unique neighborhood. We had a lot of athletes. We had a beautiful guy that lived a couple doors from me named Bayard Lancaster.
Oh, sure.
Lived three doors from me, and he was very. I mean, when you're 14 and you see someone that introduces you to avant-garde music, kind of blows your head open a little bit. So, I think I became a nonconformist like at a very young age. So the bass, when I got the bass, I just didn't understand why I should have to stand in the back behind some guy that doesn't know as much as I do about music. And I remember Bayard Lancaster used to tell me, man, you should write music for the bass. Go out there and,
put it up front, right?
Yeah, and so, that's basically what I did. A lot of my playing came from my composing, and composing comes from how a person feels, what he feels about music and how he wants to design that music in the physical universe, So, so I wrote music, and I wrote melody for the bass, and I did it. And I'll be honest, there were some people that looked at me like, boy, this is kind of strange, but I just kept doing it. And people, human beings, we love new ideas, things that are fresh. And that's one of the things I love about what we do as a people, And it was just something that was fresh at that time. Not that I was the first bass soloist. There was Charlie Mingus, there was Slam Stewart, but kind of the way I did it, I guess it was unique and people liked it. And I liked it too and enjoyed it. It was and I'm continuing to roll with that.
We're going to go back in time and play Sorceress from Return to Forever. This is Stanley Clarke's famed fusion jazz band with keyboardist Chick Corea, and this is from a 1976 album, Romantic Warrior. Let's give it a listen. Sorceress by Return to Forever, Stanley Clarke's famed fusion jazz band with keyboardist Chick Corea, 76. I don't know. That's several decades ago.
Yeah.
What's it like for you to listen to that?
Well, like I was telling you, I haven't heard that song in so long. That was a fun band to be a part of, and just some fun movement. I guess it was called the jazz rock movement originally. Then they brought in the word fusion. That band was like a traveling university. We were all learning. Chick was the oldest, but we were still all learning a lot about music and life and how art affects people and how people affect artists. Just the whole thing. And it was great because the band had very humble, extremely humble beginnings. And it went on and, that record, I think it became a platinum album or something, and we sold a lot of records, and we played in front of lots of people. And to be quite honest, we had no idea that was going to happen.
Yeah.
It was because we just wanted to play our instruments good, but we were embraced by people, and that was that's a great feeling.
Well, as you mentioned, Chick Corea came down and talked to you. You were a teenager,
yeah.
And he said, "Let's do something."
Yeah.
Is this sort of what he had? What you had in mind?
Yeah, Chick was like Chick is exactly almost to the day 10 years older than me, and so he was 28. I was probably 18, and he came down and he says, "You know, yeah, let's put something together." And you know, we didn't talk real specifics about instrumentation. It was more like the concept of, you know, let's make some music that, you know, like that people will like. Let's, because you know, back in those days, a lot of jazz musicians had their eyes closed, and when I played with Chick, we looked at each other a lot, and we thought, yeah, I wonder what that would be like if we had a band where everybody was really alert, really present, you know. And that was sort of the basis of what the band was.
I was also reading about I guess it was a lunch or dinner or something you had with Charlie Mingus. Mm-hmm. It also seemed to kind of be one of those, you know,
yeah,
seminal meetings.
Yeah, that was a defining moment in my young days. When I came to New York, Charlie had heard about me from someone, and he actually said, "Let's have a dinner." And so I go to some restaurant downtown. And first of all, I never saw anyone eat so much, you know. Like, I only ate with two people where you sit down at the table and they order platters, not plates. One was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Wow. Oh, wow.
And Charlie Mingus had these, like, platters of, like, he said, "Well, I like some corn. You know, I'm like a little bit."
Not little
no, this
dish
is a platter. It. I'm like, golly. So, but the thing that struck me about Charlie was his eyes. I got the sense that Charlie could have not been a bass player. He could have been a leader of a small country, you know, hopefully in revolution or something. You know, he was that. He just had a look of fire and determination, and he was a real, like, revolutionary at heart. Mm-hmm. You know, and he talked about the bass and something. Well, actually, he mainly talked about leadership and composition, and we were going to do something together, like. He wanted to have a concert at Carnegie Hall, and we were going to write some music together. Because what he was not drawn to me so much for my bass playing, but because I was a composer. And see, that was the thing with Charlie Mingus. He was a bass player, but really, what he was at heart was a composer.
Mm. He recognized kind of that kindred spirit.
Yeah, he recognized that, and he recognized that that was something that could grow with me.
And we close out my interview with bassist and composer Stanley Clark by listening to his 1984 song, "Heaven Sent You," with Howard Hewitt. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, Liz Fiedler, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.